We're looking at spiritual matters in the kingdom. And verse 36 is a pretty good passage on that. Because Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world." Most of the kingdoms up until this point had been of the world, but His was not. His was a spiritual kingdom. And that's what the words imply. There are certain things that disciples ought to understand and be doing. Spiritual matters in the kingdom. But unfortunately, these things oftentimes become minimized. And then once they're minimized, they're later marginalized. And sometimes in ways that are quite ingenious. So we're going to study some important spiritual matters in the kingdom today. And really these things are, well, they're basic. Now there's a few of them that might be a little different and cause us to think about things maybe a little bit more or differently. But they're things that really aren't foreign to anything that we probably already know. But I think it's good to sometimes reflect on these and realize that these are the things that Jesus requires, God requires. And one of the very first ones is that Jesus requires us to keep His commandments. That would be the first one that I would mention. Not that it's more important than the others, but I'd mention this one first because the others kind of spring off of this. And when you think about that, and think about that in relationship to a kingdom, that's really not that unusual. You know, every kingdom on earth expects its citizens to obey its laws, don't they? That's what happens here in the United States. That's what happens in all other countries. Now, whether we determine those laws are fair or equitable or decent or anything moral or anything along that line, it doesn't matter. Every kingdom expects its laws to be obeyed. And, of course, in the kingdom of Christ, the kingdom of God, that's no exception. And really, this idea of keeping the commandments is more of a test or a challenge to us. And the test or the challenge is, who is it that really loves Jesus and who doesn't? Because we understand that in the book of John, prior to where we just read just a few moments ago, you might turn to John chapter 15. We're going to look at that first. There's some things that are said about loving Jesus. And if you love Jesus, you are not going to get away with not keeping His commandments. Notice in John chapter 15. Now we're going to start in verse 1 and then read down to verse 17. "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, He takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, He prunes it so that it will bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they're burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made full. This is my commandment, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you slaves, for the slave does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you that you would go and bear fruit, and that your fruit would remain, so that whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he may give to you. This I command you, that you love one another. Now, when you consider this here, this is something that he's talking about, the relationship between the vine and the branches. But we would understand that, well, he's the vine, we're the branches, so it's a relationship between us and Jesus. And this is not something that's optional. I apologize for the run-on there. Because in John chapter 14, verse 15, prior to this, Jesus said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." So when we think about this business of keeping the commandments, well, that goes right along with loving Jesus. If you say that you love Jesus, then you ought to be keeping his commandments, case closed, and that's what Jesus said. He also said, "If you love me, you are my friends." And I'm not going to call you slaves anymore, because a slave doesn't know what the master's doing, but I've told you what I'm doing, and so I'm going to call you friends, but you're going to do what I'm telling you. And this is all under the general heading of Jesus saying those simple words, "Follow me." What does he mean by "follow me"? I think a lot of times people see that "follow me" and they think, well, that just means, you know, that you have some kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling about Jesus. Well, we should certainly have a warm feeling about Jesus, and we ought to have realize that feeling should be our love that's for Jesus, but that love is expressed or manifest not by a fuzzy feeling, but by keeping his commandments. That's what he expects of us. Those who are citizens in the kingdom are to keep the commandments. Then there's the business of joy there in verse 11. Now, these things I have spoken to you. Well, what things are they? What is that? You suppose verse 10 might have something about commandments up there and keeping. I kept my Father's commandments. Why don't you keep mine? It's like I kept the Father's. And I've spoken these things to you. Now here's the reason. So that my joy may be in you. My joy may be in you. I will see that you're keeping my commandments, and that will be the joy that I'll receive. Oh, well, we want to bring Jesus joy. We want for him to be happy. We want him to be happy with us. Well, then we keep his commandments. And then when we do that, he says at the conclusion of verse 11 that your joy then will be made full when you do that. And really, when you stop and think about something like this, this isn't all that unusual. You know, in a lot of the things that you read and things that were going on in times from the New Testament for centuries, this was just pretty much standard fare, that you keep the commandments. Until about the 16th century. And in the 16th century, things changed. Now, people give a whole lot of credit to Martin Luther and John Calvin, and I think rightly so, in trying to break away from Catholicism. But breaking away from Catholicism, they didn't go back to the Scriptures and what the Scriptures were saying. They tried to break away from Catholicism and just, well, some of the things that they didn't care for or thought to themselves to be inconvenient, well, we'll do away with those. They didn't go all the way back. Now, there might have been a reformer or two that tried to do that, you know, go all the way back to keeping the commandments. But really, Luther and Calvin didn't do that. They ended up creating a theology, both of them working together. Not together in the same room or anything like that. But both of their ideas, the one and the other, and they kind of played off each other. But their theology ended up that there really wasn't any law for disciples. There really wasn't a law, then that means, well, what about those commandments? Well, commandments are part of a law. And there's no law, so there's no commandments. They're the ones that came up with that. And that is really popularized today, isn't it? Oh, my goodness, that is so popular. I was watching something last night, and they were showing the turmoil of the 60s. And there might have been some things that were maybe needed protest back in the 60s. But I don't think everything did. And I don't think all of the violence and the civil disobedience was necessary that went on. But you think about that, what happened back then, and it was a generation, unfortunately mine, that set about to throw off all restrictions. We don't want any laws. We don't want anybody telling us what to do. We don't want that at all. And just, you know, rejected that and rebelled against it and bowed the neck. To operate as though, well, there's no law. And look where that's gone today. Look what we've got today. The number of things that have been just turned upside down in our society by people who don't want anybody telling them what to do. I don't want you to. And you know, I mean, the house over here is well insulated. Seldom do we hear road traffic noises or anything like that. It's got to really be a storm for us to hear thunder. I appreciate that. But now one thing that we do hear, we hear sirens. You know, that'll get right past the insulation in the house. We hear it. So we hear occasionally the emergency vehicles going by. That's one sound. And then we hear the police cars. That's another sound. And when they're tearing down through here, they're probably sometimes going to a wreck. But a lot of times, they're out there speeders out here. You know, it's 35 out here, and I wish that people would drive 35 on it. You know, I don't even go out to the... I go out to the mailbox to get the mail. I wait till that traffic in this lane over here is completely gone before I step out there. I just figure somebody's going to be driving along there about 50 miles an hour and see me and get target fixation on me, and then just, here we go, right over there, and take me in the mailbox and all of Mike's flowers out. So I stand back and wait till... I mean, it is. It's something that's a problem. So you hear them going by. And I wonder now when somebody gets a ticket out there for doing 35 miles an hour. I wonder how many people think, boy, we shouldn't have that speed limit here. Isn't that the same thing? We shouldn't have any law on that. Just drive as you please. Well, they'd be doing 100 out here if that was the case. And what about in religion today? Has that got into religion? Are there bodies of religious people out here someplace? They don't want any law. Now, they'll come up with laws of their own and write them all down in a creed or catechism or something like that. But boy, when it comes to this book right here and the laws that are in there and the things that Jesus said, we don't want any of that. And that started back in the 16th century. And what was... When the law for disciples went out, it was replaced with the doctrine, popular with Luther and Calvin now, of faith only. And everything's played off of that. And so what this did, it opened the door for operating by whim when it comes to the commandments of Jesus. If we like them, we'll keep them. If we don't like them, we won't. Either collectively or individually. So that's how that's worked. And it's still working up to this very day. But Jesus requires us to keep His commandments, despite the fact that we oftentimes don't do that or think we don't need to do that. That's still a requirement. Another thing that's a spiritual matter in the kingdom is you don't add to God's commandments. And I really think that whenever something like this is done, if there is an adding to God's commandments, I want to be generous about it, you know. Some folks don't really intend harm or evil when they do this. They really don't. That's not it. What it is, they have problems with the instructions as they exist. That's where the problem's at. And if we're really honest about it, you know, human beings, we've got to admit this now.
We like to tinker. Don't we? Now, come on. Now, I can remember back years ago when that stuff underneath the hood of a car was a whole lot simpler. I like to tinker with it. I like to get in there and turn a little, you know, see if I could get it, you know, run a little better, a little smoother, a little faster. I like to do that. Maybe not. I did that some with the car. I really did that with the motorcycle. But, you know, we like to tinker with things. Now, you ladies, if you get, let's say that you go to some kind of a thing, and, like a pitch-in dinner. I like that because, you know, you get to try so many different things. I like that. And sometimes I like what I'm trying, sometimes I don't, but that's what you do, you know. You're experimenting a little bit, you know, trying these different things. And so, now you ladies will go, and somebody will have something out there, I don't know, a dessert or an entree, whatever it is, and boy, it's a big hit. And you say to yourself, I'd like to have a recipe for that. I know sometimes there's been things I've had at one of these. And I'll just say to Martha, I said, you find out who made that, get the recipe for that. I'd like that, you know. You know, that's how that works, isn't it? Yeah. And you know what? You'll get that recipe, the one that you like, and you'll get it home, and you'll start to make this. Do you ever tinker with that recipe? Oh, just a little more oregano. Huh? Yeah. Well, we do that kind of thing. Sure we do. We like to tinker. And maybe that's what this is here. And look at the big companies out here in the world. They tinker all the time with mundane things like soap powder and shampoo. All this will make your hair bouncy and light and so on. And I mean, when they got that and they got a commercial on for me, that's pretty well lost. I didn't know if my hair was bouncy or light before or after. But that's what, you know, they're tinkering with all this stuff. Yeah. And here's another thing. Now, while all that's been said in a lighthearted way, you know, sometimes we like to tinker with medications. Yep. Oh, well, you know what? If that one pill does this much good, the next time I'll take that pill and I'll take half of another one. It'll be better. Or instead of taking them 8 hours apart, I'll take them 6 hours apart. Think what that'd do. And so, you know, people have been known to tinker with medication, haven't they? Yes. And what's generally the outcome in something like that? Not a happy one. No. No. We can understand that. We understand that perfectly. And despite some folks' good intention, and they don't really mean harm or evil, maybe they're just tinkering, you know. Don't dismiss this as being nothing, because despite good intentions, tinkering with God's Word has disastrous consequences. First of all, we're not supposed to do it. We're not supposed to do it at all. I have here a question. Let me get down here to it. Here we go. What government in the world allows its citizens to just add to the existing laws without recourse? What government is there? Does our government tolerate that? Does any government? Our government might tolerate that to a point. But, you know, there's a lot of governments. If you tinkered with the law, boy, I mean, off with you, you know. No. There isn't any government that you know, that are going to allow this and just think nothing of it. Sooner or later, you'll get called down. Even if you're tolerated for a while, it's not going to go on indefinitely. Turn to Mark chapter 7. In Mark chapter 7, let's look at verses 3 through 9. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands, observing the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things which they have received in order to observe, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and copper pots. The Pharisees and the scribes ask him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat their bread with impure hands?"
And he said to them, "Rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men. Neglecting the commandment of God, you hold to the tradition of men.'" He was also saying to them, "You are experts at setting aside the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition." Now, when you read this, you discover there's two problems here. The first problem here is they added to God's commandments. That's the first thing that's clear. Well, there are these traditions. You've added those. And the second thing is they set aside some of the commandments. So they were tinkering with God's word. And they were doing what they shouldn't do. You see, in the kingdom of Jesus, this isn't allowed either. Now back up there. The original question, what government in the world allows its citizens just add to the existing laws without recourse? There isn't any. And even in the kingdom of Christ, it's not allowed. Although there are multiplied millions of people that think it's just fine and dandy to add to God's commandments. As well as, well, just set aside some of the commandments. Those ones that we don't like, those ones that are inconvenient, set them aside. And if we want to bring something else in here that we kind of like and we think it's a good idea, bring that in too. And we're not talking about now matters of judgment. We're not talking about something along that line. We're talking about adding or setting something aside that changes everything completely. In the Lord's Supper, you know, there's of necessity something to keep the fruit of the vine in. Whether it's one or a multiple of them, you just know. You know, you just don't have a liquid just sitting around here somewhere. It's in something. How many of them? Well, it doesn't say. See, that's a matter of judgment. All right. But then when it comes down to the Lord's Supper and someone says, "Well, I think it'd just be fine, you know, to have the Lord's Supper on Saturday night. Or let's have the Lord's Supper at a wedding, you know. Two people want to show their dedication and devotion to God. And so during their wedding ceremony, we're going to have offer the Lord's Supper." Well, that's altogether different. You've changed things. And so we can understand that. How it would change things fundamentally by adding or setting aside. That's the real issue. Now, turn to Matthew chapter 23. We're not going to look at everything over here in Matthew chapter 23. Just go look at one thing. Just one. Jesus had a lot to say about the Pharisees and some of their errors and problems and other things along that line. But now, we're going to look at Matthew chapter 23 and verse 4. Now, speaking to the scribes and the Pharisees, you know, he says, "They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger." Well, what are these burdens and other things like that? Well, it may be things that have come about because they thought they were helping God. Or it might be something like this, you know, when you think about this, well, you know, you're helping God. Is that what it is? Now, they wouldn't lift the burden at all because, you know, they think it's necessary, so we're helping God. Is that what it is? I mean, now, is God seeking or soliciting our help in matters like this? No, not really. God wants our obedience and submission. He doesn't want our adjustments. And so, that's what we ought to remember. You know, don't add to God's commandments. Now, here's another one. And while we're in Matthew chapter 23, just stay there just a minute. Now, this may seem to be startling at first. But after you think about it a little bit, it's not quite as startling as you think. Not all commandments are equal. They're not. I think all commandments are necessary, but not all commandments are equal. Matthew chapter 23, verse 23 and 24. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. Well, they're all important, that's right. But he singles out here about love, justice, mercy, faith, that kind of thing. Now, I've added love in there because you realize that loving God is the greatest commandment, and also loving your brother or your neighbor. You back up just a little bit to Matthew chapter 21. I'm sorry, chapter 22. They came to Jesus with a question in verse 35. Which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus' answer was, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. That's the greatest and foremost. And so the second is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So you see that love, justice, mercy, and faith are the most important commandments. That's what Jesus says. And that's something that we ought to be paying some attention to. They're not all the same. That's right. And he never said at any particular time that all the commandments are the same. And as he says there in Matthew 22, loving God's the greatest. Next is loving your neighbor as yourself. All these things now are important, and they kind of stand up above everything else. But I wonder to myself sometimes, aren't all these other things like love, justice, mercy, and faith, aren't they all descending from those things, from loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself? Well, of course, yeah, that they would be. True. So we can see how the ones are included in the other. And once again, while we understand now that not all commandments are equal, that doesn't mean all don't need to be obeyed. They still all need to be obeyed. It's not like, well, you know, I'm keeping that one on mercy. What about all the others? No, I don't need to do them. Just that one. No. Well, that's important. See, that's what he was saying. The idea about those herbs out of the garden and paying tithes. You're supposed to pay tithes on everything. That would include the herbs in the garden. So that was something that needed to be done. But he says, you know what? He says, while that's something that needs to be done, there are weightier matters, weightier provisions. You take care of them. Those ought to be taken care of, you know, primarily. And then the other things as well. Now, another spiritual matter that you find in the kingdom is that we need to really be careful that you don't develop spiritual pride. That's easier said than done. I remember years ago, there was this cartoon. It was done in black and white. And the title of the cartoon, there were several in this series. It was called The Country Parson. And here he was, you know, and he had on this black suit. Of course, it's black and white cartoon, so the suit's black. And he's got that little flat parson's hat that used to be popular back in about the 1700s. He's got that on, little bitty thing of a tie here. And he's standing there, and he's standing next to a pulpit, and he's striking a pose, and he says, "The greatest thing about me is my humility." Did you catch it? Yeah. Well, of course, it's a kind of a play on words, but it kind of says something. You know, kind of poking a little bit of a knife in there, a little dig, not just necessarily at the country parson, at a lot of us. Oh, no, not me. Pride? No. That's not me. I'm not proud. Really. Really. Well, I think sometimes we may be deceiving ourselves into thinking that. One of the cases where you see this business of spiritual pride displayed, and I want to tell you what I always think about this, it's displayed about as ugly as you could possibly do it. some people might be able to get by with displaying a little bit of pride and pass it off as some kind of hybrid with humility. I don't know how you could have that together, but sometimes people think that kind of thing. Humble, had a friend of mine that used to talk about humble arrogance. Well, you talk about a contradiction of terms, that's one right there. But this is just, you can't mistake it. It's the case of the Pharisee and the publican. Luke chapter 18. Turn over there for a minute. I don't think that there would be anybody anywhere who's ever read or studied anything in the New Testament that wouldn't come out with the sense that the Pharisees were proud and arrogant people and thought that they were not. It's every indication of that in almost every case where they're mentioned. Vain, pompous, ostentatious, doing things for show, everything you could think of. And it starts off here in Luke chapter 18 and verse 9. He also told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. Now, did you see that part of it? They trusted in themselves. I know I'm righteous. Well, how do you know that you're righteous? Well, because I say so. The greatest thing about me is my humility. Well, you get the point, don't you? But that's not all that it says. It not only says that, then it says, and viewed others with contempt. You know what I get the feeling about when I see that? I get the feeling that here's somebody like this, and they think that they're righteous, you know. And when they look somebody else, they see somebody else, you know what they do? It's like this. Do you ever see that? I saw that at a gospel meeting one time. Several times. We were sitting kind of behind where the visiting preacher and his wife was, kind of at an angle a little bit there, you know. And when there would be one of the ladies from that congregation would come in and would walk past her, she gave them that up and down. And every once in a while, that. Do you need words for that? Or does that just say enough? Looking at somebody like this, you know, determining how they're dressed and so on, whether it's up to her standard, I guess. Is that not got some pride in there? Is that not kind of like this Pharisee? Do we ever do that? Maybe not with on that level, with the way someone's dressed, but whatever it is, do we ever? Verse 11, the Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself, and that's about as far as it got. God, I thank you that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector, even like this publican over here. So what is it? Well, he trusted himself, he was righteous, he viewed others with contempt, and then he words this. And I'm glad I'm not like that guy over there. And I'm so much better than him. The greatest thing about me is my humility. Oh yeah, we see all that. Pride. You know, I can't help it. When I look at verse 9 and verse 11 in this account, I just think how ugly this is. And then I think to myself, I hope I've never done that. And then the second thing I will do is that I'll have a little prayer that God, please, please let me do everything possible to keep from being like that. But instead of being like that, we ought to be like the other character in this parable. Down to verse 14. Well, verse 13 and 14. The tax collector, the publican, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. Well, you appreciate those words. And you find out that he was justified in verse 14 and not the other man. Because the one who abases himself is exalted. And the one who humbles himself is exalted. And the one who is exalted will be humbled. And so what you see here on the part of this is quite a contrast. And again, I think to myself, when I look at the publican and what he had to say, God be merciful to me, a sinner. Do you think that would be something that this Pharisee, in his present mind, would be willing to say? Doesn't seem like it, does it? So you can just see, you know, all the things in here. And it's just not a pretty picture. And so developing spiritual pride, I think sometimes, you know, we have to be on the watch for that kind of thing. There's no room for it in the kingdom. As a matter of spiritual matters, you know, it ought to be humility and not pride. Now the last point is kingdom conflicts may not be pleasant. Every place I've been, there's been some kind of conflict or another in the kingdom, in local churches, every place I've been. Some of them have been serious. I mean, mega serious. Sometimes it's a carryover from something before. And then you deal with this and so on. And they're never pleasant at all. And disillusionment often does not come from the outside. We think that it does, but we deceive ourselves. When things get rough, it's not God's fault, nor is it the fault of Jesus. We don't need to be blaming them. Now, I've got several passages here from Matthew chapter 10. They're all addressing the same subject matter. And if you turn over there, we'll take a look at those real quick. Matthew chapter 10, verses 16 and 17. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves, but beware of men, for they will hand you over to the courts and scourge you in their synagogues. So you got problems there. All right. Problems sometimes might come from without, but sometimes they come from within as well. Well, how about 21 and 22? Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, and it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. What's Jesus saying here in these passages? What we've looked at so far. Get ready. There's a very strong likelihood that this is going to happen. And we understand that not just a strong likelihood, there were times whenever it actually did happen. Maybe not to everyone, but it did happen to some. And what about 24 and 25? A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher and the slave like his master. If they have called the head of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they malign the members of his household? Get ready. It might be that there are some physical aspects of this, but here, what's this? This character assassination. This is guilt by association, where there shouldn't be any guilt to begin with. And then verse 34 and 39, do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Tell me. What does the modern church today do with that passage? What do people today who think of Jesus do with that passage? The way they view him. That he never said anything to anybody out of the way, never judged anybody, never raised his voice, never this, never that, never got dirty, you know, never broke a sweat. This imaginary Jesus that people have constructed over the decades. What do they do with this passage? Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I don't know what they do with that. Then he goes on to elaborate on that. I will set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be members of his own household. Now, he doesn't mean everybody's just going to break out into open warfare and start slashing swords around. That's what he means. He's using an idiom here, a figure of speech. I said, I've come here to separate things like a sword would do. And even in the closest of relationships, in the family, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now, we've tried to soften that somewhat over the years and act as though that passage doesn't exist, but it does, and it means just exactly what you think it means. You're not supposed to love father or mother or child or daughter or son, whatever the case is, more than me. It's exactly what it means. That's the kind of sword I'm going to put in. That's the kind of division that may come as a result of following me. He who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. Now you consider just what's right there that we've looked at. Now there are other things, but just in one chapter, look at what all's in there. It's just staggering. What do we do with all of it? Do we just kind of set it aside? Well, wait a minute, we can't do that. We can't add to or set aside things, you know. Now, this is part of it. This is what it means to really be a disciple. That's right. It really means that. I've known families where the mom and the dad, they brought the kids, you know, all the time. Made sure they were in class. Made sure the kids had their lessons for class. Discussed things with their kids that were taught. Saw their kids perhaps get to a certain age, obey the gospel. Then they got a little bit older and they all quit. The kids just, they're gone. It happens. I'm sorry that it does, but it happens quite often. And then the parents quit. Why'd the parents quit? Well, I quit because the kids quit. So, you love son or daughter more than me. That's what Jesus would say. Oh no, I still love you, Lord. Really. But you quit. Same thing happens between a husband and a wife, whichever way that goes. Or the parents quit, the kids then, they quit. We know that happens. We've known of cases like this, and yet this is addressing that, isn't it? Sure it is. You see, this is telling us that living in the kingdom, as presented by Jesus, it just may not be a picnic. That's right. It may be hard. It's going to take a special person to follow Jesus. May we remember that conflicts are likely going to come from where we least expect it. It might come from loved ones. It might come from friends and associates. It might even come from other Christians. And because of where this comes from, it causes major problems. Major problems, but not insurmountable problems. Not at all. And here's another thing to consider. How about this? While Jesus was here upon the earth, he suffered rejection by his family, didn't he? Uh-huh. And persecution by his brethren, the Jews, didn't he? It seems to me, and even his closest friends and associates, it seems to me that when you read in the Bible about Jesus, when it gets down there to the end of the Gospels, you see him pretty much all by himself, except for the Father now, who never left him. But he's pretty much all by himself, isn't he? His family, his friends, anybody? Well, they're far off. Any of his supporters. They're over here in a position of safety away from him. Well, yeah, we see that. And yet, when all that happened, and he was rejected, and he was persecuted, and other things, so then he said, Father, I just quit. Did he say that?
Well, a lot of people would say that. That's what a lot of people would do.
But what happened here with him?
No.
He didn't quit, did he?
No. No. He stayed the course despite all this.
Something that we need to do ourselves. Well, anyway, please take your songbooks, turn to the song that's been selected. As you can see, being a part of the kingdom requires serious involvement and participation. And let me emphasize that that's personal participation. One ought to be ready to count the cost and realize the commitment that's necessary to truly serve the Lord. It takes real commitment to be a child of God. Believing in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, repenting of sins, being baptized, there's commitment in that. That's right. Real commitment. But then that's just the beginning. After that, there's real commitment that's based on conviction. Because the spiritual matters in the kingdom are matters that are important. If there is one today that would have a desire to obey the gospel, or one who has a need for the prayers of the saints, we offer the invitation at this time. If you're subject, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.